From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The U.S. war in Iraq entered its sixth year this spring. Congress and the White House continue to fight over how much the war should and will cost and how we should pay for it. Economist Bill Spriggs has been following the debate. He joins us this Memorial Day to parse out the funding wars and what they mean for our future. Bill is a professor and chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Farai.
So the president has framed this war as a response to the 9/11 attacks. For more than 5 years, the president continually pushed for more funding.
Our men and women in uniform should not have to worry that politicians in Washington will deny them the funds and the flexibility they need to win. Congress needs to send me a clean bill that I can sign without delay. I expect Congress to do its duty and to fund our troops, and so do the American people.
That's the president making the case for last year's war spending bill, and he seems to be using the same tone for his latest $163 billion war funding package. So why does he make these specific arguments?
Well, he is making those arguments so he can justify spending the money off budget, and that breaks down the discipline of what we do and hides the cost to the American people of what's going on in Iraq.
Explain to me what you mean by off budget.
Well, even though people don't believe it, Congress actually does act in a responsible way. The president submits a budget at the beginning of the year with the State of the Union address, and then Congress responds by having hearings and deciding how much money they will spend, how much they will take in revenue, and if they need to, agree on how much of a deficit they may run. After they've made those agreements, through a lot of deliberation, they then pass authorization and appropriations legislation to get things done. The president is going around that process and saying, oops, this is an emergency. Every year the president does this, not just with the war. Take Katrina as an example, where a hurricane wipes out a major city. You can't anticipate that in a budget. It's sort of like in your own household. You may budget for the year, but suddenly the radiator goes on your automobile or your hot water tank bursts, and most of us then pull out our credit card to cover what we didn't anticipate in our budget. The president's doing the same thing to Congress. He's saying, this is an emergency. The hot water tank is going, and we got to hurry up and get it fixed. Give me the money, and we'll worry about it later.
It sounds as if you believe that this money could be budgeted into the regular budget.
Well, if you buy an older home, you will end up finding that you do have to replace the hot water tank, and then next year you have to do the refrigerator and then the dishwasher and then the oven. At some point, you have to look at someone and say, you know, it was an older home. Didn't you anticipate, and why didn't you put this into your budget? The president has carried on this war now for longer than we did World War II. It's no longer the case that this is an emergency or something that was not expected. Many of the costs are recurring costs because we are there and he's committed to staying there. So it's a little hard to say it's an emergency and should subvert the budget process.
This time around, this year, the president is facing some pushback from Congress, who have decided not to pass the funding bill. Here's a clip of Illinois Senator Dick Durbin saying why he decided to vote against an Iraq spending bill. Now, last year, he voted for a similar bill.
Sending a blank check to this president for this war is going to prolong the killing, prolong the deaths, the injuries that will return. And this president wants to hand off the ball on January 20th, 2009 and walk away.
Now, what do you make of the fact that folks like Dick Durbin are jumping ship this time around?
Well, because they're tired of the way the process has been misused. When the Defense Department gives a regular budget proposal, they go through great detail in explaining why we need this missile system or why we need this airplane, and they justify it. And they give you each item and why it's there. In the case of the war, it really is a blank check. They just broadly say, we need money for equipment. We need money to move personnel. They don't explain which equipment. Why are you doing it this way as opposed to that way? Is there a cheaper way to do it? Did you really think about this expenditure? It's just absolutely a blank check. It does not have the same discipline of the rest of the budget. And then what the president has done is not fully fund all of the cost of the war, because some of these things get hidden into the portion of the budget that would be discretionary. For instance, when we take care of veterans, this was mentioned by the senator, when we take care of veterans who are wounded, that shows up under the Veterans Administration, and that is discretionary spending. That and the regular budget has to be balanced against a pot of money that's lumped together with military construction. So the choices that Congress have are, I can do the responsible thing and cover the medical expenses of our veterans, or I can cheat the current fighters in our Army and not build adequate housing for their families, or I can cheat them out of the subsidies they get for when they live off base, because that pot of money means that kind of trade-off.
Well, you mentioned health care costs, and we recently had former Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala on the show. She was the Health and Human Services Secretary under President Clinton. Recently, she co-chaired a task force for the Veterans Administration, and it looked into how the military was taking care of some of its wounded soldiers. So here's part of what she said.
Much of what we recommended required that both the military and the VA do things differently, not necessarily new resources. But some of the things we recommended definitely require new resources. The president has started the process of investing in those resources that are needed, but I'm never going to say we've done enough or we have enough resources dedicated to these brave young men and women.
Now, this commission, the Dole Shalala Commission, it was called informally, recommended, among other things, that there was lifetime care for soldiers with PTSD and long-term mental health care. So how will programs like these, if they're implemented, affect the overall cost of the war?
That's how we get closer to the bigger numbers you have maybe seen in the press. Joe Stiglitz, who has done a series of reports on the cost of the war, has a book out saying that the cost of the war to the American society is going to be close to $3 trillion, and a large part of that has to do with the long-term implications for what we do with these veterans. It's hard when you look at the budget because that only says what the VA is willing to do, and so it ignores the huge backlog that is built up of servicemen trying to get treatment. So claims now are months in waiting for close to 400,000 troops. And you have the issue that when they become disabled, they become in part an expense of the Social Security system because they will show up in the disability rolls of the Social Security system. We have another set of hidden costs, and those are the private contractors who are wounded or killed under hostile environments. The contractors are required to carry insurance, but that insurance doesn't cover what happens in a hostile environment. That type of injury is covered by the Department of Labor, and those expenses come out of the Department of Labor. So those monies could go to job training, as an example, or they could go to other things that the Department of Labor does, like enforce wage and hour protections, things like that.
So, Bill, when I think about numbers that are in the trillions or billions, it's hard for me to process them. Can you explain what these figures really mean?
Yeah, it's really very hard because $1 trillion is a lot of money. But if we just think about last year when we spent $138 billion on the war in terms of what that could have done for us as a society, Bob Poland, who teaches at the University of Massachusetts, has estimated that for the same $138 billion, we could have covered the 45 million Americans who are uninsured. We could have given them Medicaid insurance coverage. So we would have had no uninsured Americans in the United States for that same amount of money. Or if you think about it in another way, he points out you could have paid 30,000 school teachers and built 400 schools for them to teach in. You know, just take that $138 billion, multiply that times 1,000, that gets you to the $1 trillion. And so many times over, there would have been no uninsured Americans, and we could have built many, many, many of the schools that need to be built in the United States over again.
This is a little bit more of a political question than an economic one, but we have heard here on News and Notes different people who are the families of veterans and other people saying, look, this money could be used right here at home. But in general, although there's a high disapproval rating for this war, there doesn't seem to be a groundswell, a cry to say, you know, we need this money spent at home. Why do you think that is?
Well, in part because it is hidden. when the president does it off budget, it doesn't immediately press against domestic priorities. So we don't see it in exactly in that way. When Congress meets to figure out what to do with the war, they aren't having to make the trade-off. They aren't having to say, well, we'll have to raise taxes or revenue in order to pay for it. So we're putting it off to another generation that will have to pay the debt on the right now $800 and some billion that we have borrowed.
How do you think it's going to affect the future, that not only do we have these high costs, but much of it is being rolled over into essentially what is the government's credit card, you know, borrowing money in order to maintain the spending?
It couldn't come at a worse time. In 2010, the Social Security system switches over from its current status. Currently, we collect more in Social Security taxes than we pay out. Beginning in 2010, that stops. So the government's extra piggy bank runs out of money. We will then begin to pay down the debt that we owe to Social Security, and that will be a drain on general revenue. Then we have the health care costs that we must meet of our seniors and our Medicare, and that will require increased expenditures. So already we know going forward we have a lot of obligations out there. The current baby echo generation is bigger than the baby boom generation, and a higher share of them are going to college. So we're going to have even greater demands on how we will get our people educated. So with just those demands out there that we know exist to our young people and to our seniors, it says you can't borrow any more money. You have to tell us how you're going to pay for it. It's going to be a very rude awakening as we have to pay the interest on this debt.
Oh, Bill, thanks for this update.
Thank you.
William Spriggs is professor and chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. He joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. In 1944, an Italian prisoner of war was lynched in a riot. It took place at Fort Lawson in Seattle, Washington. 43 black soldiers were charged in the incident. 28 of them were convicted. More than 60 years later, the Army Board of Correction overturned the convictions. The military found major issues with the soldiers' court-martial. Joining us today is Howard Cooley. He's an attorney with the law firm Patrick Henry. The firm represented the family of Booker Townsell, one of the soldiers charged in the case. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So tell us about Booker Townsell. Who was he, and what had he been through before and after the court-martial?
He was a young man who was drafted in World War II, like so many other people. Seems to have had nothing remarkable about his background from what I'm able to understand, but he did become quite remarkable during World War II because he became a prisoner. He had to guard some prisoners of war, some Italian prisoners of war, and the riot broke out. And then as a result of that, he was convicted. He was dismissed from the service with adverse honors. And then from that point, he had a great change in his life, because with that adverse discharge, dishonorable discharge, he wasn't able to secure the kinds of benefits that he wanted to. And he had to overcome that. And I think the great story of his life is what he did afterwards for the duration of his life and leading his family. He was an ordinary person under remarkable circumstances.
Now, unfortunately, he passed away in 1984. So how did you get involved with the case?
Well, it all goes back to Jack Hammond, who is an author who wrote the book. He did some research. He found out he's from the Seattle-Fort Lawton area, discovered that there was something very unusual in terms of a courts-martial, and then sought to investigate the matter. And when he did, he uncovered essentially just a tremendous miscarriage of justice, very well documented. He researched it. He published the book. And at that time, the family members came forward as he did more and more research in terms of trying to find and locate the individuals. And from there, I became involved when the in last September when Congressman McDermott's office asked me to assist some of the individuals with their cases before the Army Board for Correction of Military Records, and that's how I, for example, got to know the Tonzell family.
What was supposed to have happened or presumed to have happened when these men were court-martialed? What crime were they court-martialed for, and what actually happened? What did we find out about that?
He becomes a pawn in international intrigue. There's a riot that goes on, and the police believed, the military police believed that the African Americans were involved, instigated the riot, and then as a result killed one of the Italian soldiers. We have, here we are, we have an Italian prisoner of war who's now dead, maltreated, and the government decided it needed to show the rest of the world, particularly the Axis powers in Europe, that it would not, that is, the United States, would not tolerate this kind of misconduct and would deal with it swiftly, very swiftly. And that's what happened. These individuals were all charged en masse, tried en masse. They didn't even have the defense lawyers that they had didn't even get an opportunity to know all of the individuals. And the trial just went on, and then they were convicted. What Jack Hammond unearthed was that Leon Jaworski, the great prosecutor in the Watergate matter, had some evidence that was potentially exculpatory that tended to show that some of the white military police were involved in this matter, that actually instigated it, knew that something was going to happen, didn't stop it, let it go on, and were the shared in liability here. Nothing happened to them. And this evidence and this information was suppressed, in this instance, a shared culpability, because if you have a duty and a responsibility, if a police officer sees someone being beaten or something happening and you don't, and the police officer turns a blind eye, then the officer then shares some liability with regard to what happens.
Now, there are only two surviving soldiers left as part of this case. What kind of compensation has the military given them so far for post-exoneration?
The persons for whom the cases have been decided, and Mr. Snow, his case has been decided and has been very well publicized, the Tonzell case. The Army does not publish or give a list of the other cases that have been decided, so I don't know the exact number, but I don't think it's been very many. I doubt it's been five or so decided. For some of those individuals, the standard relief and for most of them would include the Army would say, "All right, you were taken off of active duty too soon, so we're going to reverse your dishonorable discharge, and we're going to put you back on active duty for the period of time that you were serving. That is for the period that enlistment period. So if that enlistment period had another 6 months to run, or another 7 months to run, or whatever it was, they would then pay the individual for that." That's how Mr. Snow and the Tonzell family, I might add, received a check for $700 or so, or something of that nature from the government. Now, the bill that was submitted by Congressman Congressman McDermott, thank you, was designed to pay interest on the amounts that the Boards for Correction of Military Records determined should be awarded.
So what would you like to see, Mr. Cooley, happen from now on for the families of the soldiers who've passed away, for the ones who are still alive, and just in general for the record?
Well, I think that a letter of apology to the individuals the Secretary of the Army, particularly in those cases where there has not been a significant celebration. We had a great one for the Tonzell family in January January 19th. The Assistant Secretary of the Army was there. Congressman McDermott spoke. It was a tremendous program, but not everyone is going to be able to receive that kind of program and that kind of salute. And so I think a personal note from the Secretary to those families would be appropriate. The other thing is, not all the family members know. Many people don't know that their father or their grandfather was a participant in this. And I think some meaningful public relations effort to ask those people to apply, because they have to apply to get relief. So I'd like to see that. I think that would be appropriate.
Well, Howard, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
That was attorney Howard Cooley of the law firm Patrick Henry. He represented the family of Booker Townsell in the case of black soldiers court-martialed in 1944. He practices law in Annandale, Virginia, and is a retired Army colonel. We Were There, Voices of African American Veterans from World War II to the War in Iraq. That's the title of a book by New York University journalism professor Yvonne Laddie, who wanted to preserve the unique experiences of black veterans. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So your book is an oral history of the unrecognized contributions of black war vets. So when did this project and why did this project first come to mind for you?
Well, it really began for me when I was a little kid, and my father used to talk to me about his service in World War II, and he used to talk a lot about the discrimination, and he would always end his like little sermons with how proud he was to serve, and like I thought he was crazy, because like I couldn't imagine why anyone would want to put their lives on the line for a country that, you know, wanted to lynch you. So you sort of fast forward to 9/11, and I'm a reporter at the Philadelphia Daily News at the time, and I cover 9/11, and it's, you know, it's horrible. And afterwards, I was watching television and reading the newspapers and seeing all, you know, basically white people waving flags and all this patriotism and all this love of America and how it made them feel really good and connected. And I wanted to feel connected, and I never really felt connected to my own country, and it really upset me. And a couple of weeks after that, I got a phone call from a Vietnam vet who wanted me to write an obit about a World War II vet who served on a submarine and was basically a hero. And I was so moved by his story, and I realized that this is where I connect, and this is where all African Americans connect to America. I mean, our people have served and have done so much so that people like me can have the opportunities that I have. And so I guess it's a story of, in a way, of me searching for who I am, searching for my history, searching for my people's history.
Give me an example of one of the stories that you found about a World War II veteran.
Well, one of the veterans I interviewed was a man named Waverly Woodson, and I saw the movie Saving Private Ryan, and I thought it was a great movie. But I was really struck by the fact that there were, like, no black people in it, and I assumed that no African-American served on D-Day. But when I started writing the book, I really wanted to find an African-American who served on D-Day, because I soon found that that was not the case. And I searched and I searched and I searched, and I found this man named Waverly Woodson, who was a medic, who was in the first wave, and because they were just bringing in a lot of medics because, you know, people were getting killed left and right. And the landing tank that he was on was blown out of the water. He crawled to the beach, he was wounded, and he wound up, you know, setting up a first aid station and saving hundreds of lives before he finally collapsed. And when he did collapse and they tried to get him help, when he was revived, he went back and tried to save more lives. I mean, he amputated legs, he was jumping in the water and pulling people out and trying to save them. After it was all over, people were talking about him getting the Medal of Honor, because, I mean, it was incredible what he did. But, of course, he didn't get it. And of course, no one ever heard his story. And of course, he just went on, you know, with his life and did the best he could after that. But he was like an incredible, incredible hero. And when I interviewed him, God, probably 2 months later, he had a stroke. A year later, he was dead. So these stories are like, I mean, they're disappearing every single day.
When you think about a story like that, where someone gave his all and didn't get a lot of credit for it, is that a theme that runs through the book?
It definitely runs through the World War II section. I mean, pretty much all the vets who served in World War II. I mean, I have a vet who was at Iwo Jima, another story you don't hear much about African Americans serving there. Also a Buffalo soldier I have who came home after, you know, fighting in Italy, the worst of Hitler's troop, comes home, the ship lands in Virginia, and the white people in the town turn their back on the black soldiers. They don't even want to look at them. I mean, it was, they walked through the town, he said it was like they were convicts. People turned their backs on them. And he was with me at the Smithsonian. We had an event for some of these vets, and he cried when he talked about that, and everyone in the audience stood up and cheered for him. And it was 60 years later, but it was like he was coming home that day. And that's a story you hear over and over again. But at the same time, these African Americans never, ever gave up. It wasn't like he came out and then became an alcoholic and, you know, started, like, robbing banks. I mean, he joined his father's church and became a preacher. Waverly became a doctor, a forensic doctor anyway, a pathologist. I mean, one of my Tuskegee Airmen became a scientist. I mean, others just took advantage of the GI Bill and you know, got married, have kids, put their kids through college. It's all the stories you don't hear about black people are these stories. These are the stories that make you feel so good about who you are, that make you stand up stronger and taller and feel proud. And these are stories our kids do not hear. And it kills me, you know. It really hurts me because it is so incredibly empowering, to hear these stories. Because they're not stories about people shooting each other and war and death and all that. It's stories of triumph over unbelievably difficult circumstances.
Do you think that we're in an era of redemption where many of the if not all of the unsung heroes getting their due, at least there is a growing recognition in some quarters that African Americans have played a role in, from Crispus Attucks forward. Do you think that people are starting to learn this?
Well, I think some are, but it's not happening quick enough. And, I mean, I think you saw it a lot with the World War II Memorial dedication in Washington a few years ago. You know, there was very few events that, you know, where African Americans were there. And because of the how difficult their stories are, because it's not only fighting the Germans, it's all the racism. A lot of them don't want to talk about it or don't talk about it or don't know how to talk about it. So you have to push harder to get the stories. But I think when people hear them, they celebrate them and want to know more. And now, you know, there's Spike Lee's doing a movie, and hopefully that'll finally give African American World War II vets their due, because it's
Miracle at St. Anna is the movie based on a James McBride book.
You know, World War II was very cut and dry. It was like, these are the bad guys. You know, we're fighting for, you know, freedom, and not just for Europe, but for ourselves, for our people, to prove that we are more than what people say we are. That's not happening in Iraq.
Well, Professor, thanks for the interview.
Well, thank you.
Yvonne Latty is author of We Were There, Voices of African American Veterans from World War II to the War in Iraq. She's also a professor in the Department of Journalism at New York University. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On Memorial Day, we honor the men and women who've died to protect our nation. But what about the soldiers who make it back home? How do they and their families cope with the effects of war? Sonia Parker is married to Army Sergeant Michael Parker. He recently returned from a tour in Iraq, and adjusting to civilian life hasn't been easy. Sonia, thanks for coming on.
Hello.
So, let's start with your husband, Michael. He spent 11 years in the Army, and he recently returned from Iraq. How's that transition been for him and for you?
It's been very hard because we're here in Houston, and Houston don't have a home base. So my husband left Germany to return straight to Houston. It have been really stressful and just dealing with a lot of ups and downs after, you know, coming home from a war, and it's no help here in Houston.
Now, some people who've gone to Iraq have gotten physical injuries. Other people come home with invisible wounds of war. What is Michael dealing with?
He's dealing with PTSD. He have a back injury, he have a wrist injury, and he have some hearing loss.
So when he came home, how was he different in how he treated you, related to you, related to family life?
He's totally different. For one, Michael is very quiet. And since he returned, he's even distant. And it's causing a lot of problems in our marriage. And it's just, this war have caused a lot of stress on the wives and the families that have to deal with these soldiers when they return.
What do you try to do with or for Michael to help him adjust?
I try everything in the world, and it seems like it don't help. Because he have a wall built up, and for one, we don't have enough help here. We only have one clinic that we can go to for counseling and therapy, and it's like 2-hour drive away from where we live, so that's a major problem too.
And what about you? I mean, who's taking care of you?
Me. I'm stressed out. We have so many soldiers that's returning here from Houston that losing everything because it's no help here. It's no funding. I'm trying to find out where's the funding. We went through our savings because it took Mike 8 to 9 months to find a job. That's a long time. And I called over 300 numbers for help. And out of 300 numbers, I have 6 organizations that nonprofit. And I got a problem with, why do we have nonprofit helping returning veterans? Where's the government?
How did that make you feel?
It makes me feel sad. It makes me feel sad for my husband.
Now, let's talk a little bit. You know, you are clearly someone who is going through all sorts of things right now, but you're also helping other people. Tell us about the work that you do with veterans in Houston.
Well, it's not just veterans. I help homeless, you know, whoever needed. We were stationed in Germany, and when the Katrina and Rita hit, I flew back here to help with the Red Cross with the Katrina and the Rita. And also, I go out on my own to pick up donations, clothes, food, whatever I can pick up for the homeless veterans that's here in Houston that's living on the streets.
When you think about the challenges that you face and the things that other people in your area face, what specifically would you like to see?
I would like to see for the government to stand up and do what they need to do for these returning soldiers, because we say we support the troops, and then when they come back, they're not getting the support they need.
How do you feel this plays out in terms of issues like race, education, and economics? And what I mean by that is that America's soldiers and Marines don't necessarily represent every group in society. Although there are fewer black soldiers than there used to be, black Americans are still more likely to be in the military than white Americans, you know, as a percentage of the population. You also have a lot of folks entering the military who really just want a job and who are entering with a high school degree as opposed to a college degree. How do you feel things are playing out in Houston in terms of who goes into the military and how they're treated when they come out?
I think none of them need to go. None of them should go. I think they all should come home. And I say that because of my experience and what my husband went through after he returned. He's fighting for nothing. And when he comes home, he have nothing. And when my husband felt like giving up, it was only me there. And we didn't have nobody to go to. And I just feel like it's all for the wrong reason. And I feel like the government, the president of the United States, he say this and say that. Me personally, I would want him to talk to me in my face, because we sending funding billions and billions of dollars overseas for what? When we need it here.
When you look ahead at your life with Michael, are you hopeful that things are going to get better?
Yes, very.
Sonia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sonia Parker is the wife of Army Sergeant Michael Parker, who is now back in civilian life, and she joined us from member station KUHF in Houston, Texas. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On February 22, 2005, Merlin German's life changed forever. He was a Marine sergeant in Iraq, and a roadside bomb exploded, burning him over 97% of his body. That would kill most people, but Sergeant German survived and kept his sense of humor through multiple surgeries. People at the Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas, started calling him the Miracle Man. Sergeant German even went on to found his own nonprofit to help burn survivors. But last month, he had what was supposed to be a simple follow-up surgery and passed away. Sergeant Merlin German was just 22 years old. To tell us more about his life and legacy, we have his brother, Ariel German, plus a dear friend of his, Norma Guerra, Department Chief of Public Affairs at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Ariel. When and how did you first learn that your brother was injured?
I can actually remember that exact day. It was about 1 a.m. in the morning. Three Marines came knocking on my door. They were actually looking for my mother, but she was living in the Dominican Republic at the time, and they were able to tell me what was wrong. And while I waited for them to get clearance from Washington, I kept asking one of the Marines to give me a flag, because he had said if he passed away, they would give me a flag. So I kept saying, "Where's my flag? Where's my flag?" But then they came back and was like, "Well, we can only tell you he's been burned. He's okay, he's alive." But at first they had said he was only burned about 70%. And every time I kept in contact with them, the percentage went up.
What was it like when you first got to see him?
It was stunning. I was shocked because the nurse kept talking to me, telling me about the procedures that I have to put on, scrubs, and I had to wash my hands. But I was like in space, just staring at his toes, because that's the only thing that weren't covered. And when she was done talking, I asked her, that's Merlin, right? That's my brother." And she's like, "Yes, that's him." So I was really, really, really scared.
I've seen pictures of him as a sergeant, very handsome young man. And then afterwards, the understandable amount of scar tissue, the change in his complexion, which was modeled by the skin grafts. Norma, a lot of people would look at themselves in the mirror and say, what's happened here? He lost most of his fingers, from what I understand as well. What kind of person was he in his spirit and his attitude towards life?
Oh, God. I mean, he was amazing. At first, he used to say, "I've been burned 97%. You know, I'm not going to be able to do nothing. And, you know, why didn't the good Lord just take me away?" And things like that. But after he started getting stronger and stronger, then he kind of switched his tune, and he said, "Wait a minute, I was burned 97%. I only had a 3% chance of living. I can do whatever I want to." And his attitude just completely turned around. And he just became an inspiration to everyone here, to all the guys that were getting here after he did. And, of course, after he was up and able to get around. And, I mean, he would get up out of his room and go around and motivate all the other guys that were here and walk with them and say, "Look, I could hardly walk, you know, a few months ago, and look where I am now." And so he was just inspiring.
To even be able to walk must have been something that at least some doctors and nurses thought would be impossible, given what had gone on. I mean, how exceptional was he in terms of the recovery he was able to make?
The docs couldn't believe it. Everybody was baffled. They started calling him, of course, the Miracle Man, because here was a kid that was not expected to live. And I remember sitting in meetings every morning and hearing about his condition, you know, getting either worse, or maybe, you know, he would kind of take three steps backwards and then one up and two, you know, back and forth. And everyone expected him to not make it. And all of a sudden, he proved everyone wrong. I mean, people weren't on. You know, his age had a lot to do with it. He was young. His strength, he worked out immensely. and he was in good physical condition. So those were all pluses for him. But mostly the doctor said it was his spirit of wanting to live, because a lot of people want, and he decided that he did.
Ariel, it sounds like he made not just the best of a horrible situation, but he was able to change other people's lives. But I wonder what he was like when he was younger. What was he like when you were growing up?
Wow. He was a character. He was very, very tough. Very tough, always. At times, you can say he was a bully to kids that were smaller than him, because he was always kind of stocky, but he also defended a lot of people. So I can say he was always very tough. He had a big sense of humor also.
The sense of humor that got him through some of this.
Yeah. It helped us also, because he would laugh while we were, like, you know, all scared and wanting to cry. He would be like, I'm burned. I'm like a fried chicken. I'm like, don't say that. He would be cracking up, and then I had no choice but to laugh.
How did your mom, how did she deal with this?
She was, at first, she cried a lot. I mean, as any mother would, but then she said that she would never leave his side again, and she never did.
Norma, he was having what should have been a very routine surgery. What went wrong, do we know?
No, he made it through the surgery fine, and he was doing well. They did an autopsy, and it showed that it was respiratory, probably. That's all I really know, that it had something to do with his respiratory. And, you know, you have to remember that there has been probably no other like him, you know, and to survive that percentage of burns. So it was almost like, you know, everybody was going from one day to the next, saying, wow, he's made it again, and look what he's doing now. And, you know, so it was a shock to everyone. You know, it was just a shock, because he was doing great, you know, a few days prior. But like I said, no one else had ever gone like that. So he kind of was setting the standard for, you know, surviving those type burns.
Ariel, tell us about the work that he did with Merlin's Miracles. I mean, you know, to think about his journey into the military and then through these surgeries and then to help other people, what did he set out to do and what was he able to accomplish with his group?
He always wanted to help kids. He always loved being around kids and playing with kids. By the way he looked, a lot of kids a lot of times would be scared of him, but then, you know, he would joke around with them and they'll start getting comfortable with him, and that was his passion, to always help kids.
Norma, how do you see the work that he did?
It's amazing. He had started it, and it's going to live on, you know, through his friends and his family and the people that loved him. And I think a lot of children and their burn children and their families are going to benefit from it. And I hope it does live on, because it will be him living on for the rest of the children that are going through the same thing. He always, Merlin loved to travel and go places, and he would always tell me, he's like, Norma, you know, I want to do something so that burn kids can have an easy time getting places and doing things, and they need AC for their house, because, you know, he knew how miserable it was not to have it, or if he was sitting outside for a minute, you know, how bad it was, or he'd have to sit in the vehicle with an air condition. Can you imagine a child that didn't have air condition because, you know, the family simply couldn't afford it, or things like that? And don't you think, Ariel, that's kind of where he was going?
Yeah.
Ariel, you know, on Memorial Day, we think about people who've passed away. When you think of your brother, do you think of him as he was before he was burned, after he was burned, or now perhaps his spirit, you know, beyond life?
When he got hurt, I always treated him the same way he was before he got hurt. I never, you know, was sorry for him or pitied him. I always was tough with him, as I was when we were young, growing up. So now, as I think of him and think about what's happened, I'm very, very proud of being his brother, because I can say my brother made a difference in this world, and he touched a lot of people, especially my life. I see things a lot of things different now because of him.
Ariel, Norma, Thank you for sharing your story.
Oh, you're welcome.
Ariel German is Sergeant Merlin German's brother, and he spoke to us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando, Florida. And Norma Guerra is the Department Chief of Public Affairs at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas.